are listening to The Leonard Lopate Show on AM 820 and 93.9 WNYC.
In Tom Stoppard's play Arcadia, characters in the present day try to unravel the mystery of what happened in the same English country house 200 years earlier. As the play switches between the two periods, time begins to blur and the characters in both eras make discoveries. It was a big hit when it was first produced at Lincoln Center in 1995, and now it's being revived on Broadway at the Ethel Barrymore Theater on West 47th Street. Arcadia is scheduled to run through June 19th, and joining me now are Billy Crudup, who plays Bernard Nightingale, Tom Riley, who plays the 19th century Tudor Septimus Hodge, and playwright Tom Stoppard. I'm very pleased to welcome them to our show today. Hello.
Hi.
Hello.
And Billy, you played Septimus Hodge in the Broadway production in 1995.
That's correct.
Did you, Tom, talk to him about the role?
This is the first time we've spoken, actually. We were in rehearsal for 6 weeks and he wouldn't look at me.
We've ignored each other up to this point. We didn't actually really talk about it very much, did we?
I mean, not at all. And I wish you had been there to talk to me about it 15 years ago, because you seem to have picked it up very quickly, and I'm deeply resentful of that.
It's one of those things where it's a part that you kind of have to find on your own. And Billy's been great enough to sort of understand that. And I know, I have known that if I have hit a brick wall, then I would have been able to go and ask him.
Because think you know that.
But Tom shows up at rehearsals, doesn't he? Tom, you like to come to rehearsals? So have you been giving them advice?
Well, I came for the first week, and then I came back in the last stages and the early previews. It's not really to do with advice exactly. I'm one of their first audiences, in a sense, and I have responses which may or may not be useful to the actors, and essentially I'm a sounding board for it. I mean, I have to be careful not to come into the room with my own predispositions, because very often it's actually better if the actors find a different music. Very, 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 very seldom, Billy and Tom, I should say, but just now and again, they actually have a better way to do things.
Well, you told the New York Times about your love of screwball comedies, Howard Hawks, His Girl Friday, and that you wanted that kind of rhythm where people are practically stepping on each other's lines.
Well, yes. What I really was attempting to say was that there are passages where we can take lessons from that kind of cueing. Cueing is when you pick up your line and so on. And it's not actually very naturalistic. It's not actually realistic, but it's incredibly exhilarating for these passages. And you see it in movies right through the 30s and 40s. And then around about the 50s and 60s, it's more usual to see actors, stroke characters, receiving a line with great interest and turning it over in their minds. And while the camera is kind of staring around, they finally deliver a response. It's absolutely fascinating. I want to kill them.
So it's because we rely on the reaction shot to cue the audience as to whether something is funny or not. Hmm. In the past, I think those great script writers, Hecht and MacArthur and all, they knew that they were being funny and they didn't have to tell the audience.
Hmm. Yeah. You're right. Comedy has its own imperatives, and you have to respect them. And I'm only being half serious. I mean, I really do genuinely find actors fascinating people. I could never be one, but I love being in a rehearsal and watching them and hearing them find the rhythm for things.
Well, in most plays that I've seen recently, when there is a laugh line, the actors stop and they wait for the laughs to end. But, Tom, that's not allowed here, is it? So you just plow right ahead.
We like to give the impression that we're plowing right ahead, but it's necessary to give the slightest of pauses just to let that laugh die and not lose the next line. But we do try and come in as rapidly and quickly as possible so as not to lose the rhythm of the scene.
Now, this revival was produced in London in 2009, but it's taken 2 years to come to New York.
Well, it's not that it's taken 2 years. The show finished in London. The actors dispersed. We were sort of half talking about trying to bring everything back together.
The and same after, director.
Oh, yes, it's the same.
David Lebeau.
It's the same scenic designer, same director. It's the same production. But we started from scratch when it came to casting it, partly in London, partly in New York.
David Lebeau has directed a few of your other plays, Jumpers, The Real Thing. Have you developed a kind of a shorthand with him at this point?
I'd like to put in the fact, because it's so strange, that that those plays and this one, all three, have been on the same block. Why is that, do you think? We've only worked on West 47th between Broadway and 8th.
They've got to start calling it Stoppard Row.
Or Lebeau Row. But anyway, we've done three plays together in New York. His congenial company. And, you know, the thing about theatre, I find the whole thing quite stressful if you let it get to be stressful. So I have the attitude of Evelyn Waugh in the Second World War when he's being bombed and so forth. I mean, he said the great thing about being in the war is to spend it among friends. I feel rather the same way about being in a rehearsal.
Well, did you, in your case, Billy, you were in this play before in a different role.
Mm-hmm.
And it's always interesting to see somebody get a little older and take on a different part in a play that he or she performed in many years ago.
Mm-hmm.
But it was a different director as well. Did it feel like a totally different play this time?
Well, it's different in many respects, not the least of which that the play is sharply divided. And so it really is two different plays that sort of find their way together. And I don't think I fully appreciated that until I started to work on the present-day version of it. And that was a little intimidating, actually, because having been around the play for so long before and it being such an impressive experience and memory for me, I thought that I had a better understanding of what was happening in this century. And I was sorely mistaken, and that was a good 2 weeks lost of work. However,
this is kind of like being in two separate one-act plays.
Well, two separate three-act plays, probably. It's an impressive undertaking, but there's not a practical interaction between the two centuries until the final scene, and even then, it's only by proximity. So you don't get to relate to the other characters and have an understanding from inside the experience as to what's happening in the different centuries. And that actually makes for a very new experience. So for me, it's as though I'm doing a new play while hearing a recording of one that I've done for so long, although done much more interestingly.
Well, Tom, this is a mixed cast, but mostly American actors, isn't it?
Yes.
How did you wind up in it?
They were casting in London. I assume it was David implied it was quite a long process, and towards the end of that process, they did a week of casting in London, and I happened to be, I was working up in the north of England, and I was back for one day. Unfortunately, that day coincided with the days of auditions.
And you play Septimus Hodge. Can we get a little recap of the plot? Although this is, I guess the plot isn't all that complicated. It's all the details that are so wonderful and complicated. But Tom, do you want to give us are you willing to recap your own play?
You mentioned in your introduction that the play takes place in one house, but in two different periods.
And you don't even have to change the set.
No. In fact, one of the nice theatrical things which appealed to me when I was even beginning to think about writing it is that the only piece of furniture really in this room accumulates a sort of inventory from both the early 19th century and nowadays. And there's a set of characters who live in the early 19th century, and there's a set of characters who are living now. And they each have a story, but it's something of a double helix, or at any rate, the two stories begin to dovetail because the modern-day people are trying to figure out what happened 180 years ago, and we, the audience, know, so which is where some of the fun is.
And we know where they're going wrong and where they're going right.
Yes.
The only constant other than the table and a couple of flower pots and things like that is a turtle.
Indeed, yes.
And I have a friend who said she spent a lot of time wondering whether that was a real turtle or a mechanical turtle.
That's impressive.
Success.
Well, we're not telling you.
We're not going to tell her.
It's a trained tortoise.
Well, your character, the character you're playing here, the scholar Bernard Nightingale, is the one with the theory about what happened in the earlier version.
That's right.
He's all impulse and gut feelings and hunches. Does he just not think things through?
Well, I think he feels like the spirit of life is living, you know, just beyond your means, and that if he is taking chances, that he's closer to experiencing the poetry that comes from, I don't know, everyday living. And since he can't be a poet himself, for whatever reason, he doesn't have that engine, I think that's the closest he can come.
But he does have a strong sense of himself, and is not reluctant to insult people. And he doesn't seem to have much respect for the scholar who's already there, Hannah Jarvis.
It's true. She was
She's
the author
more methodical
of
than he is.
Well, she was the author of a book that he felt was reductive and oversimplified the person that he spent most of his time studying deeply, Byron, and glorified a sort of bit player in Byron's life. And I think he probably felt that a bit insulting and trivialized his life's endeavors. So therefore, the easiest route to take is to deride her.
And, Tom, you play another bit player in Byron's life, at least according to Tom Stoppard.
Mm.
What's he doing in the house?
Byron.
No, you.
Me. Oh, I'm the tutor to Lady Thomasina, who is the young female, I suppose not the heir, because she wouldn't have been the heir at the time, but the Lady Croom's daughter, and brought into the house to home educate her, which I assume was the only possible form of education for a girl at that age in that time. And he is his school friends, or was school friends, was at Harrow with Lord Byron, who he has brought to the house with him as a guest. And he's setting all the women's feathers ruffling.
Well, he is, yes. He is the object of many women's affections in this story. He is teaching a young woman who may be smarter than he is and maybe smarter than practically anybody in the world is.
Yes.
It's hard to be a tutor. As smart as your character is,
yeah.
Who's smarter than a young Thomasina?
Well, I think that's a part of what makes it so fascinating, Septimus anyway, is that the arc from this carefully constructed position of wit and intelligence that he is pretty sure is comparable to his friend Byron, who appears to be getting all the plaudits. And by the end of the play, he has had to come to terms with the fact that Thomasina is certainly, if not necessarily, she doesn't necessarily have the faculties to put together what she is discovering, but somehow she has taken that extra leap. I think, as Tom says, she is in the house without opening the door.
We're talking about Arcadia, which is now at the Ethel Barrymore Theater at 243 West 47th Street and running through June 19th. And my guests are Tom Riley, who plays Septimus Hodge, Billy Crudup, who plays Bernard Nightingale, sometimes Bernard Peacock, depending on who he is talking to, and the playwright himself, Tom Stoppard. And we will continue our conversation after we take a little break. Stay with us. We're back with Tom Stoppard, Billy Crudup, and Tom Riley. We're talking about Arcadia, which is now at the Ethel Barrymore Theater at 243 West 47th Street, with a run through June 19th, and I assume that's it? You have to go back to London, Tom? And Billy, you have another project?
I don't.
Or would you like to see this thing go on forever?
As long as it can.
Yeah, as long as people want to come and see it.
Absolutely.
Now, all of these people, the people in the play, are your inventions, aren't they, Tom?
Yes.
The only real person is Byron, and we don't...
He's off stage.
He's off stage the whole time.
Yeah.
But he is really the MacGuffin in this whole story in a way because he creates all the mystery.
Yes. Well, the character played by Billy sees that he can make himself famous by a literary discovery, as he supposes, about Byron. And in a way, actually, Tom plays a Byron substitute. I don't quite mean that literally, but he's a Byronic character. And Byron, he was pretty much the most famous person in Europe, one has to remind oneself, a little, you know, in the second act, our second act. He's an incredibly famous person. He's like Mick Jagger or, you know, as famous as Muhammad Ali. Really, a Byron play, a real Byron play, is still to be written. I mean, they were sending him little snippets of pubic hair before he was really an author of more than a couple of poems.
There have been a number of films that have attempted to capture the, the story, but
they
never really have done it right.
Well, the story
Are you tempted?
At present, no, I'm not.
Even,
I have
even
to say.
With those snippets of pubic hair, as a
it's
a
to do
device.
With. I'm not really tempted to go back into the period at the moment with that kind of language to write and so on. But somebody somewhere is writing a Byron play or movie or book every moment of the day, I would think.
Now, the interesting thing about Septimus is that. He really is responsible for a number of things that Bernard thinks Byron did, and that's part of the fun for us in this play. This Septimus Hodge has disappeared historically, but we, watching the play, know what an important role he played in this story that Bernard is trying to unravel.
The trouble with Arcadia as a play to talk about is that after about 5 minutes of talking about it, one's leaving the impression that it's some kind of homework one has to do. In fact, it's a kind of detective story with a thread of a love story running through it.
And a fair number of laugh lines, too.
And a lot of jokes, some of them cheap, I'm happy to say. We like to think that it's a good, fun story.
But there are all those weighty ideas. Here discuss... iterated log algorithms, quantum mechanics, chaos theory, I get the feeling that you have to teach yourself all of these things, or at least enough to make it convincing.
I personally, to write the play, you mean?
Yes. You can't get it wrong, can
you?
No,
you can't get it wrong. But, we live in a really interesting period, which I find very, very gratifying, and it's the period of popular science books. Huge amount of science literature out there being avidly read, bought at airports, not studied in libraries. It's very pleasing.
This is also about the cusp period between the Enlightenment and Romanticism. And that obviously is very important for you because it's something that comes up again and again throughout the play.
Well, Lea Williams plays a character who feels very strongly about that, and the way she puts it is that it's a decline from thinking to feeling. And we live in an age where one would question the verb, the word decline. Is it actually a decline, or is it an ascent to feeling? And this tension between thinking and feeling, in a way, it binds all our lives. We're always finding a place of poise between the intellect and the heart, to put it, use it metaphorically.
And Septimus is almost the embodiment of that, isn't he, Tom?
Of?
He is both a very well-educated man, fully aware of all of the important ideas of his day.
Absolutely.
Knows a lot about mathematics. Mm. And the play begins with rumors of him having had an indiscreet meeting with the lady of the house.
Well, I think it depends on your definition of feeling, whether feeling is a sort of lofty artistic
Well, he said, doesn't he say sex is better than love?
He absolutely does, right at the top. And I would say what's interesting about that tension is that more it comes from an intellectual point of view at the top of the play, and by the end he is overwhelmed by feeling.
Mm-hmm. And Bernard is all...
He goes from feeling to feeling.
Yeah, is feeling to feeling. But he thinks that he's an intellectual.
Which is an ascent for him, actually, somehow. I don't know.
Well, in both cases, both men are not the smartest person in the room. In the case of Septimus, as smart as he has this 16-year-old girl who may be one of the,
in the case of
the
Bernard,
great geniuses.
Because there's anyone else in the room.
Well, but Thomasina may be one of the most brilliant people of her time, or
absolutely.
Potentially.
Yes, yes, she may.
And it's always rough to be the tutor of somebody who knows more than you do.
I think so, but I think that is really something he only lets himself accept over time. Mm-hmm. It's only towards the end where he is just, okay, what have you got for me?
Whereas Bernard never believes that anybody is smarter than he is.
Absolutely not, and I have to say that's a very comfortable position to be in. For the first time.
Well, but Tom, you've written these brilliant female characters. In fact, they are always the smartest person in the room.
I'm rapidly thinking back through the CV. Certainly it's true of this play and this character, Thomasina, who has a mathematics imagination in advance of her time, let alone her years.
Well, she's thinking about Newton and perhaps trying to improve.
She's essentially stumbling into an area of mathematics which didn't really emerge as being useful or intelligible until the 1960s. So, you know, she's a long way ahead of her time, but quite plausibly, in my opinion, I'd like to think, because it's not it's not difficult mathematics. It's just that it involves a huge leap of the imagination, which I think actually is very often what genius means, that it's having the thought which everybody feels they would have had if only they'd thought of it.
Well, but how did you wind up thinking of this? Were you I suspect all of those ideas weren't there at the start.
Well, I'm a bit of a magpie. I collect shiny bits of information, and I get to a point in my life where I'm more depressed about not writing a play than I am about working, and start trying to use these little shiny things and put them together so they make some kind of a little sculpture, which is called a play because it's a sculpture of narrative. The best thing is not to, I think the best thing is not to try to write your play before you write it and hope that you get lucky. And Arcadia, I have to say, is a really lucky play. It just fell out fine.
Well, you have talked about giving a tutorial to cast members.
I look forward to this.
Oh, no, this is,
I read the New York Times.
You're letting the listeners in on one of my more embarrassing experiences where the cast asked me if I could explain the second law of thermodynamics.
Oh, yes, because it does come up in the play a couple of times.
And there was a time when I could have done this without any problem. But as they asked, it was one of those where my mind went totally blank. I didn't have the beginnings of a memory of... And then when I sort of got out of the room, it all came back to me. But, it wasn't a tutorial, actually. But when we originally did the play, we actually had a professor, a mathematical biologist, come in and talk to the cast. And he tried to do it on the simplest possible level he could manage. And it was way over everybody's head. So he then had to have another go for John and Jane Go quantum surveying.
But does it really matter for the actors whether they understand thermodynamics or not? as long as you deliver the lines.
Well, certainly not for Bernard. He doesn't have to understand much. I defer to Septimus on this one.
And I would defer to Raoul, who plays Valentine, if he was here.
Oh, Raoul Esparza, yeah. Who is one of the great deliverers of funny lines in the world, don't you think? It must
absolutely.
Be a pleasure working with all of this cast.
It's a wonderful cast. Mm.
Can you gauge the way the audience is reacting to your characters?
You can. That's something that's fascinating about Arcadia is you can not only gauge how they're reacting to your characters, but you can kind of gauge if they're making the right connections. You feel.
So some nights you feel they may not be making the right connections.
Some nights you think, that bit's gone by the wayside. We need to improve on that. And other nights you just feel a ripple of, that and that and that, and you can just tell that people are with you.
Because they laugh at certain things, or they,
It's not even that. Sometimes it is a laugh. Sometimes I think
you
again,
can feel
it's
an
Thomas's
awareness.
Laugh. Mm. Laughter is the sound of comprehension. Mm. There's also just a sort of just a feeling. I can't put my.
So what happens if you think that they're not getting it? Do you then change the way you deliver some other lines, or
we just do all the
scene?
Lines really fast to get to the end of the play and go home
and offer a
substantial
refund?
Maybe they'll come back tomorrow and figure it out.
Well, you learn. I mean, the process of doing Arcadia in those small measure over the course of previews is what happens if you miss the smallest moment. There's an enormous effect, often for the other century, because Thomas constructed a play where the payoffs are coming from people on the other side of time.
Well, many of the characters are offstage, but they play key roles in the story. That also must have been part of the fun of writing. This was like a Greek tragedy where so much of the important business takes place off stage.
Well, it's one has to try to get the right balance. Sometimes if something too important is off stage, maybe the audience for whom the play is written might feel deprived in some way. I don't know. I never actually theorize about things because that's not really how I get to write anything. It's a very strange process which I don't understand, and I don't like to even try to understand it. I will say that what the boys were just talking about, it's not that difficult to get a laugh from an audience. It's difficult to get a sigh from the audience. Mm. And that's really what Billy was talking about. There is a sigh of comprehension, which is pure gold for a company of actors.
The equivalent of aha.
It's a sort of thing, I get it, I'm with you, I've heard you, I understand what you've done. And that subplot, not subplot, but subtext of plot in the play, I have to say, publicly, etc., that it's looked after in this play by this company as well as I've ever heard it looked after. And it's difficult to do it because it's not just to do with, say all the words in the right order and they'll all get it. They won't. One has to actually understand what one is saying in the moment of saying it, and then the audience get it like a kind of contagion.
In plays like The Coast of Utopia and The Invention of Love, you've made historical figures into characters. Here, the only historical figure is discussed but never on stage. Is it in dealing with the history, doesn't that give you a certain amount of freedom that you don't have to worry about whether somebody out there says, oh, no, Bukharin wasn't like that at all?
The last time I was here in New York with a play, they were fictitious. The time before, almost nobody was fictitious. That was The Coast of Utopia. Mm-hmm. And I think that this isn't a cop-out or anything. I think there actually is something called truthfulness, which is different from accuracy. I don't know that a sort of a historical pedantry is particularly valuable. But truthfulness is absolutely essential. And it's to do with what people were thinking and feeling about themselves, not, which bus they caught or where they were on July the 15th. It's not about that.
And you're speaking, Tom, in a kind of an early 19th century form of English. I don't know if you've done plays from that period, but does it require some kind of adjustment?
I wouldn't say adjustment so much. It just requires care. The way the two different periods are written are actually very different to one another. There's a lot more overlapping, a lot more modern day colloquial speech in the modern period, whereas with ours it's a lot more clipped and careful and witty, and it's just treating it like a piece of Wildian writing, and not the modern day tendency is to dip at the end of lines and to let things drop and throw things away, and it's just giving weight to everything that deserves that weight.
And Billy, you've been all over history in Tom Stoppard plays. The first playing Septimus, then you were in Coast of Utopia, and now you're playing a contemporary character. First of all, what is it like to go through the full range of Tom Stoppard writing?
It's fine. Say anything you like.
Say it's miserable.
The truth is, I'm slightly apologetic about it only because Tom has to hear it. You know, I felt as though I won the lottery when I got a chance to do Septimus on Broadway the first time.
And it did make you set your career in motion, didn't it?
No question about it. And that is a, kind of once-in-a-lifetime experience for an actor. So to get an opportunity to play like Belinsky after that I feel ashamed of it. So to get to do Bernard on top of it, I feel as though I'm being unfair and taking away opportunities from people to have a chance to explore, the playwright that I'm most interested in collaborating with. And so for me, it's an unbridled dream.
Well, Tom, this is your first time on Broadway, isn't it?
It is, yeah. This is
well,
mine.
Maybe you'll be back. Tom has written quite a few plays.
And I'll be back as Bernard in 15 years.
I want to thank you all for being with us today. John Bradley, who plays Septimus Hodge, Billy Crudup, who plays Bernard Nightingale, and Tom Stoppard, who's created those characters and many other wonderful ones in Arcadia, which some people have called your most perfect play. I don't know whether you feel that way about any of your works, but you have to be pleased with the way people love this play. It's at the Ethel Barrymore Theater at 243 West 47th Street, and it's running through June 19th. Thank you all so much.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thanks.